Welcome back to The Brandon White Show, where we have conversations worth listening to give you an edge to win in your business and your life. I'm your host, Brandon White. Here we go. I'm so excited to talk to you. I've been excited to talk to you for a few weeks. And when you wrote back to me, you said, oh, well, I'm not sure that it fits into your show. And this year I've tried to expand the show and change the name, which has changed three times. But, you know, I think sort of like life, you sort of eventually find your groove, but you got to keep stepping back up to the plate. So I think, Risa, after 470 episodes, that we might have found an interesting show to have, which I'm trying to expand. Like I heard a podcast of you. I found you through a podcast that you were on a Twitter thread.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah. And I said, this lady reads tea leaves and smoke. And it reminded me of tarot cards and the, what's it called? The Ouija board?
Yeah. Yep. No, I know what you're talking about.
And then I did some more research, and it happened, just so happens in the small world that it is. And maybe that it's just the energy of the world of how it happens, but you're actually from Maryland. And I think you're Ellicott City, and you were in news and you were a writer, and then you turned into this smoke reader and tea leaf reader, which I know that's a better word for. And I have always been fascinated with this. And I have some friends who use things like this to help inform their life. And it's one of those things, which I'll just be candid with you, that it's sort of like, wow, is that really real? And then you start looking around and it may be real. And if it is real or not, really doesn't matter, as long as it's real to you and it helps inform you.
So, that's correct. Yes.
Thank you for being on. I was actually watching some of your shorts yesterday. You were doing some tea leaf readings in general for the month of July, I think.
That's right.
Yeah. So thanks a lot. I'm interested to find out how all this works and how you transitioned from a writer into reading tea leaves and smoke.
Well, do you want me to just jump in?
Yeah, I do. I do.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I'm a journalist by trade, which means I'm a skeptic by nature. And I still hold a healthy amount of skepticism about all things in life. So going into the divination arts is kind of an unexpected step for somebody with that kind of a background. And I think, though, that it only helps me. It only helps me to try and present unbiased and real information to my clients when they come seeking knowledge from wherever it's coming from through divination. And, you know, that's a hard question to answer. Where does it come from? Because I would say it depends on the person sitting in front of me. I simply read the tea leaves or the smoke. I don't create the images that are there. And I have taught myself symbology over the course of many years. I can simply interpret the symbols that are presented to me. I don't know that I can tell you exactly where they come from. Some people believe they come from a higher self. Some people believe they are messages from ourselves, literally. Sort of a hard reflection, an exercise in self-awareness, maybe. Other people do believe that they come from loved ones on the other side, or a spirit guide, or even the spirit entities that are in a space. I can't say yes or no to any of that. I don't think anybody can. And it's sort of a personal question to each person who seeks out a divination artist of any kind. Now, tea leaves and smoke are a little different than tarot cards. I am a third generation tarot card reader. It's something that's been in my family a long time. And I actually have here, I brought up to show you the deck that's been in my family a very long time. This is what it looks like. It's pretty worn out. It's like 50 years old.
Good Lord.
And I did learn to read on those, although they are not the most popular kind of deck that people read anymore. This is called a Tarot de Marseille, and it doesn't have people in it nearly as much as the contemporary decks. This is what most people think of when they think of a tarot deck. It was a deck drawn by a female artist named Pamela Coleman Smith, and she gave faces to all the cards. So most people are accustomed to seeing that deck. And I could show you those later if you want. But tea leaves and smoke don't have 78 meanings. They have infinite meanings. They are fully open. And within the framework of a teacup, for example, literally anything can come up. That's a coffee mug. This is a teacup.
Oh my God. Pronounce your name again for me.
It's like, Rissa.
Rissa. I don't know why. It's dyslexia. Rissa. Rissa, this is a coffee mug? And you would distinguish that?
Absolutely. I could not read that cup. It is too deep and it is dark inside. This is a teacup. It has a low, shallow bowl and it's not very deep. And it has this nice big opening that when I finish this cup and turn it, I'll show you. You can look down in it and it's very easy to see.
Okay, that makes sense because you need to, it has a wider opening for listeners. It's the traditional, air quotes, teacup. Mm-hmm. And it has to have, you have to make your tea, obviously, with loose tea.
Yes. I do have loose tea in my cup right now. Obviously, I can't show you that on camera. But these come with a saucer like this. You know, it's kind of old school, like you would expect a proper British lady to drink out of, right?
Right.
I will show you how I turn the cup here in a minute. I'm not quite done this cup of tea yet.
So what made you, how'd your family get into tarot card reading?
I don't know the answer to that question. And the person who first picked them up is no longer around to ask. But here we are. I remember them growing up. It didn't seem weird or unusual to me because it was something that was just always around. And I, to be rebellious as a teenager, said, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to learn to read tea leaves instead. And that was quite an accidental beginning, to be honest with you. I was gifted a bag of loose tea and a tea ball when I was maybe 15 or 16. So that was a number of years ago, honestly. I'm 48. So over 30 years ago, I was given this gift. And it was a piece of crap. The tea ball was junk. It broke the very first time I used it, and the tea was loose in my cup. But growing up in a small town in Pennsylvania, loose tea was really special. It was not something to be wasted or taken lightly. So I kept the tea. I drank it loose in the cup. And during that process, I said to my mom, there looks like there's a cat on the inside of this teacup. And she said, well, you know, that is a kind of divination. Maybe you should see what you see. And I was definitely a very intuitive child. I very much believed I saw ghosts. I very much believed that my hunches were right, and they almost always were. As I got older, I kicked back against that and became a journalist and became a just the facts type. But at that age, when I was still fairly young, I was completely open to my intuition, and I was very well guided by it many, many times in life. So I started drinking my tea loose in the cup. You might not know this, but the tea bag itself is only about 100 years old. Previous to that, people either used strainers, if you were wealthy enough to have one, or people just drank tea loose in a cup, and it was a normal function of tea drinking, which is something like 3,000 years old. So that said, it didn't feel weird to me after a while to drink my tea loose in a cup. Now, I don't do that every cup of tea I drink. People ask me, is that the only way you drink tea? No, I still drink tea bags. I still have tea strainers. I don't drink all of my tea loose. Some of it, yes, not all of it. And that day I started, when I was 16, with the cat, I started keeping a notebook of things I saw in teacups. There was no Google at the time. There were no websites to interpret those symbols. And my local library had nothing on the subject at all, not even about just interpreting symbols. So I started gradually assigning meanings to symbols, and it became my own set of language that has carried on through my entire life. And cat eventually came to mean home, and the different postures of a cat would tell me the different states of somebody's home. Dogs were loyal friends. The second symbol I saw in a cup was a basket of flowers. I went on to develop many, many more. I took folklore and I minored in art history. I studied literature. I took a lot of things that symbolism weighed heavily in as a college student. And I learned that symbols change from region to region, country to country, and over time. I always like to tell people, if you remember the movie and book, The Da Vinci Code by Dan Brown, Professor Langdon had a PhD in symbology. It's that big of a field. Symbology is huge. Nobody knows every symbol, and individuals can have their own unique symbols. I'd love to give you an example. This was something I that was really not expected to me. I was reading a teacup for a young woman, and I looked in her cup, and I saw a Sasquatch, a Bigfoot, playing a guitar. I thought, okay, I'm messing this up. I'm not seeing it right. I've clearly missed the boat here. But I've learned over the years to trust myself, even when it seems weird. Turns out it was her boyfriend. He's in a band and they dress up like Sasquatches and play their instruments. And that's like their gimmick. That's their shtick. And she knew exactly who it was and exactly what it was about, even though I thought I was wrong. I thought I was wrong. And the cup was correct. Another really funny example, I was reading for a gentleman and there was an iguana with a martini glass. And I thought, once again, this has to be wrong. He was asking specifically questions about his family situation. Well, turns out they call his mom the reptile and that she drinks martinis all the time. But I would have never guessed that. I certainly didn't know it going in. And it was another one of those situations where I simply trusted what was in the cup. I see your mind ticking. What's you thinking about?
Well, how does this happen?
So somebody who wants a tea leaf reading drinks their cup of tea and then you give it an upside down turn. Usually there's a little more movement involved, like swishing it around or something, just to get the tea to stick to the inside of the cup. And then from there, I look at it and I do a drawing and I'll show you some of them and I can email you pictures of some too. So everybody's cup is completely unique.
Yeah, for listeners, we're looking at the bottom of a teacup, which is the remnants of the tea leaves. Mm-hmm. Yes.
And here's a totally different one.
Mm-hmm.
And
I'm very impressed. You're very prepared.
I am a journalist.
Yes.
So you can see they're all totally different. And there's not even repeating symbols in all of them from cup to cup. It did take me a long time to feel confident enough to read for the public because there are so many unique and individual symbols. And then in 2020, when the world went virtual, I started doing tea leaf readings for people all over the world. And a money symbol to us is not the same as a money symbol to someone in Australia or Asia or somewhere in Europe. Their money symbols look different. So I had to kind of widen my gaze and understand that the symbology of where the person was might inform how their teacup would look, not necessarily as I would have expected it to look, but more as it would be pertinent to them.
My question was actually deeper. Meaning,
okay.
I don't know, deeper. That would make me sound like I'm a deep person. It's a different question. It's
okay.
So someone who's listening to this says, there is no way that you would see Sasquatch and that person would then have a boyfriend who dressed up as Sasquatch or this, what was the other one? The salamander with
the iguana. Yeah.
The iguana with it. My question is, how do you do that? I mean, there's no tricks here. You didn't do a internet scrub before the person came and
know people's names before they come sometimes.
Right. So it's very hard to, would be hard, maybe not to find the boyfriend, but I mean, the other one would be tough. It has something to do with either, well, let me use this analogy. So we had a lady on who I think is going to be on release today or tomorrow on equine therapy.
Oh, yeah.
And it turns out that, and I grew up with horses, so I get it. Horses are magical.
I grew up with horses too. Yeah.
Oh, you did. Okay. So you understand. I mean, they don't have a frontal cortex. So they are reacting. They are prey. Mm-hmm. So they are always on alert. And the therapist is really paying attention to the horse. I'm not saying that the therapist isn't smart or good at their craft, but it is equine therapy. There's a horse involved, and their magic is reading the horse.
Yes.
Who is reacting to the person. Mm-hmm. That is the real magic of, and it's funny because, as you know, growing up with horses, horse people will know about the other person by them interacting with the horse.
Yes, absolutely.
Right. And then you'll know so much about a person and you're not even a therapist. So I'm using that analogy because what the magic there is they're in tune with those reactions and the symbols of ears turning, ears back, snorting, looking away, walking away, which is a simple one, or coming towards you or whatever that is all being read. You, in what you're doing, seem to take this to another level that appears to be in touch. I hesitate to say dimension because I don't know how to explain it other than I describe these things as energy in the universe. There's energy in the universe. You have to recognize it to see it. And most people are so busy that they don't see it.
I would agree with that.
Right. So are you just so in tune with it? Like, you can't be lucky that many times to get that right. That's basically, I think, what I'm saying. So there's something. Can you articulate what that is?
I do understand your question. And I want to first go back to your very first comment. You said there are people that will say there's no way. And I will say to them, that's fine. That's totally okay. There are the moments when I'm skeptical too. And I have a background as a journalist. I'm used to being able to verify facts. And here, I don't think that I can. It was a big leap of faith in myself to undertake this as a profession because it went against everything that I had practiced professionally for a very long time. And I love being able to lean back on data. It's nice. And it makes it a lot easier when there are numbers and facts that support what you do. But you're right. This falls into a different category. Tea leaf reading, smoke reading. I wouldn't call myself a medium if anybody's wondering what that is. A medium is strictly a person who interacts with the dead. That's not what I do. And I have certainly run across people with gifts in that category that I cannot explain with data either. And years ago, I did a headshot as a photographer for a woman who had been a medium working for various law enforcement agencies. She was responsible for finding over 200 lost people. I don't think that's luck either. I think that's pretty remarkable and I can't explain it and neither could she. So as far as how I see these very specific symbols, first of all, I've learned to see symbols in a teacup over the course of many decades. And so it's easy for me to pick out what's relevant and what's just junk in the bottom of the teacup. And from that point, I just simply trust my intuition, which perhaps you could say is the energy of the universe. You could say is the same kind of thing that's a hunch or a gut feeling that journalists follow, that police officers follow, that everybody who researches anything can say, I had a hunch. I had a gut feeling. Even in people's personal lives, we have those moments where we can't explain, but we have a knowing, a gut feeling. And, I've read articles where people say that's a function of like your gut bacteria. I certainly don't know anything about that, but you're more intuitive apparently if you have healthier gut bacteria, according to some data that people have collected. Like I said, I'm not a bacteriologist. I can't explain that.
We'd have to see that research to know if it's like really scientific.
Right. And even things that are done in good faith in science can fail to be replicated. So that said, maybe this is a knowing from the universe that I'm able to get quiet enough to hear. I have spent a lot of time in the past many years getting into a quieter place within myself where I'm not as rattled by day-to-day life, where I'm not as drawn in by the constant stimulation of our society. And it has served me in many other ways as well. just to feel calmer, just to feel more centered, just to be able to focus on my other writing or research without the static in my head from everyday life. So is that related? Maybe. As I've done more readings, I have found it easier to find that same focus elsewhere. So it could be the same kinds of states people reach through meditation or yoga or a regular walking, mindful walking practice. Same idea. You're quieting your mind enough to A, have peace, and B, hear yourself think. Is that also connecting me to some other knowing? Maybe. I mean, I can't say for sure. There's definitely no data to collect on that.
Well, how did you decouple yourself to basically quiet your mind? Like, do you have a technique? People meditate. I mean, I'll tell you how I do it. It's really simple. I get on my bike and I push myself to the extreme, which basically puts you into a primal state where the only thing when you're going up a hill at a decent pace that you can think about is surviving.
Right.
Because your heart rate is going, which then for me quiets everything in my mind and lets my subconscious, if that's a thing that you believe or not, basically do its own thing. Mm-hmm. And after that, or when I'm recovering from a hard effort or whatever you want to say, or even after a ride, that's when the magic happens, or it'll even happen to me in it. Meaning there'll be this flash that happens like, oh, that's the solution to that problem. And I've learned to do that maybe just through trial and error of my life. And I don't think it's good or bad. Like, some people want to meditate. Like, and I'm sure if I really tried, I could get that. I tend to want to be in this other state. I also wonder sometimes if these things make us drug addicts. And what I mean by that is that it's a fact that you're releasing dopamine, norepinephrine, and other drugs during these things. Mm-hmm. That in turn is creating a behavior, and you do become addicted to that. So we're actually addicted to our own drug. Is that bad or good? I don't judge it. It just works for me.
Right.
And if it works for someone else, but most people don't even take the time to figure these things out. What did you do to figure that out, to get this quiet? Because when you're quiet, you can listen to the other things. That it's not that I think these other things aren't there. I think that people don't pay attention, or their mind isn't quiet enough, because what I say is most people have kids. They're in a four-person household, and they're just trying to get the kid out the door to put the peanut butter and jelly sandwich, the Doritos, and the Capri Sun in the bag, get themselves out the door and get to whatever job they're doing, however that works at home or something else, which has its all these other dynamics that never really allows your mind to rest.
Absolutely. Day-to-day life can be incredibly demanding and can take away that quiet space. Absolutely. And in many ways, in many moments, it's simply not practical to try to have those practices. The scenario you're describing, where someone has a multi-person household and there are multiple people with jobs and school and after-school activities, it's very difficult to even carve out 20 minutes a day for yourself. Absolutely. So I'm fortunate in that I have a life that I can do that. I can carve out time for myself every day. So it's changed for me over time, to be totally honest with you. I have done many different things to reach quiet space in my head. And meditation was very difficult for me to arrive at, because I'm a doer more than a beer. And I would rather be actively doing something than sitting quietly with my thoughts, or without my thoughts, as it were. And it has taken me years to arrive at a place where I'm okay with it. And I still can't sit in meditation for an hour. I have not gotten to that spot yet, but I have arrived at a place where I can meditate every day. Usually in the morning, I get up before anybody else, and it's still very quiet. It's no problem for me to get up at 5 and carve out time for myself to meditate. I love it. My phone's quiet. My email's quiet. Nobody's trying to get my attention at 5 a.m. So it's the perfect time for me to do that. It might not fit everybody's lifestyle, but it works for me. And I would be totally honest with you, with walking, because it's an active thing. I could enjoy it with a dog. I walked for certain amounts of time or over certain spaces. And I just said, I'm going to do this for this amount of time and nothing else, no phone, nothing else. So that was the first step for me. Journaling came next, and then guided meditation and visualizations were the next step until I got into a space where meditation became doable. It was a transition. I wouldn't say I've perfected it. I wouldn't say that I have reached a spot where I've mastered it, but it has definitely changed my life, to be completely honest, especially the journaling practice. I don't journal every day, but I do journal a lot, and it has proven much more beneficial than I could have imagined. Years ago, a therapist recommended it, and I kind of rolled my eyes, to be honest. I was like, I don't see how that's going to help, writing in a diary. But she was right, and I was wrong, and I'm okay admitting it. And I wish I could find her again and tell her, but obviously she's retired and I was never able to track her down and thank her years later. However, that said, it has made a big difference to me, just finding different ways to reach the place where I can be quiet within myself. And it makes it much more doable to have a practice like tea leaf reading. I will tell you, if I am arriving at a tea leaf reading, whether I know the seeker or not, who's going to be sitting in front of me, and I'm jangled and I just had, you know, a terrible driving experience, I usually need a few minutes to gather myself. I can't jump right into it. I need that moment to sort of quiet my breath, my heart rate, and reach that sort of peaceful plane in my head so that I can do the reading for them. I can't just step into it. It's not like when I worked as a journalist where there was an adrenaline thrill of chasing a story. It's literally the opposite.
What were you working on in therapy that you had a therapist?
Oh, I've worked on lots of things in therapy. I'll answer that question. Years ago, the first thing I was in therapy for was a sexual assault. And you asked.
Well, yeah, I did. I'm curious, but it's a terrible thing.
It is a terrible thing. And it did take me a long time to find enough peace to accept it and move on as part of my past. But you never forget things like that. You never forget.
No, I think that's an unrealistic expectation. And just to, so that we're on a fair playing field. Most people that I've encountered in life have some sort of struggle, trauma, sad story, whatever. My grandfather killed my grandmother and killed himself. Like, that's a pretty major thing, right? Like, I mean, I can say it now with, like, I can see your face, and probably listeners are like, holy crap, like,
yeah,
what in the world is that? Well, that's sort of crazy. But you're never going to forget that.
No.
But one of the things that I'd be interested, because obviously sexual assault is very traumatic and can be, but you can recover, obviously, is, I believe, and I've been studying this because I've been trying to write a book on it, but I actually think it's as simple is and this complex at the same time, that being happy is wanting what you have. That doesn't mean you like it.
Yeah.
But you do want it, because if you don't want it, you can't deal with it, which means you can't get past it, which means that you're stuck with it. Mm-hmm. And that now it's renting place in your head on a regular basis. And I'm not suggesting that's easy, but I am suggesting that if you don't do the work, it will rent that place in your head and you won't overcome it. And then it will have this drag on you. So yeah, I don't know. That was really, I guess, me sharing so that doesn't feel like we're on an uneven playing field, because I think that everybody has these traumatic things and you got to figure out how to get past these things. And if you don't want what you have, I would suggest that you're in a lot of trouble. And that really is happiness, because it doesn't mean that you are happy. Like, I'm not really happy that happened. I mean, it was any more than you are, right? Like, but would I be the same person? Would you be the same person? Would you be reading tea leaves?
Well, that's hard to say. I have no idea. No. Maybe. No. But I don't think I would be the same person, and I wouldn't see the world in the same way. I don't know that I would have become a journalist if that hadn't happened to me. I became a journalist because I wanted to be a truth teller in the world. I wanted to help communities to have their voices. And even as a journalist, that's a lofty ambition. And it's very idealistic. It is the words of a 20-something going into journalism until you find out that journalism is a for-profit venture. And there are people who I'm sure are in it for the right reasons and who have great passion for truth-telling in the community, for being, as was said a long time ago, the watchdog of a community. I don't think that's everyone. I don't think that's all journalism anymore. And I think that the business that I loved as a journalist has deeply changed, even in the past decade. I know when I was an editor at the Baltimore Sun many years ago, and things became about, in meetings, they were discussing stockholders, not what our next story was, what the plan was for the paper. But what would the stockholders think of a story like that? And should we pull it? And I remember the moment when it hit me that the Baltimore Sun was a for-profit venture. And it was not what I thought my career would look like when I got to that point. So I moved on and found other things to do. But it is a sobering moment when you realize that the ways you can reach the world have a lot to do with how you see it.
So back up, we go to therapy for sexual thought. You work on that. Mm-hmm. You mentioned that there were other reasons.
Mm-hmm. Well, over the years, I have worked with therapists on and off. Dealing with transitions a lot has been helpful. And I've been incredibly lucky and privileged that I got to talk to therapists, that I got that gift of being able to go to therapy. Like I said, my first time talking to a therapist was about the sexual assault. And after that, different transitions in life were probably the main thing. Transitioning, say, from being a college student to being a working professional, I definitely needed some support through that. I needed some support from therapists overcoming challenges in everyday family things. I needed support going through, I was divorced. I needed some support with that. And I was just lucky that I was able to work with several different therapists over time. They all had their own approach, their own way of seeing. So that was incredibly useful to gain different perspectives and different systems of therapy as well. I remember the first therapist recommending meditation to me and me going, yeah, that's just never going to happen. And here I am decades later, and I found a practice that works for me and I like it. But I wasn't in a place yet back then to sit and do quiet meditation. So,
well, I do think it takes a lot of work. I got lucky, or however you want to say it, lucky or unlucky, but depending on your perspective, to work with a sports psychologist since I was probably 15 years old, mainly from a very early ACL reconstruction that I had when I was 13, I think, mm-hmm. and playing lacrosse in Baltimore. And as you can imagine, they call it sports psychologist, but it's really all about your life. At the end of the day, that's all the things. And I think you've used the word therapist, psychologist. I tend to think that almost everybody, some of the things you said were just, and I was curious, but listeners probably are thinking what I was thinking, which was, well, those are just like life events that happens mm-hmm. to everyone. And maybe through that professional coaching, and I'm not going to use coaching. I hate that word. it bothers me because I did go get a master's in psychology with a degree in counseling. I think because I figured out that it was going to be cheaper to counsel myself than it was long-term to hire someone. But coaching, I don't think, I'm not saying all coaches don't have the skill, but the rigor of going through an educational process to become a psychologist is a different process. And I think people don't understand completely the responsibility that you have when you do that.
Because I would agree.
People are not, it doesn't mean you and I are fragile or other people who are listening to this are fragile, but you get divorced, you are going through a pivotal moment in your life, whether you wanted it or not. And you're at a vulnerable spot where someone who doesn't know what the hell they're doing can set you back.
Absolutely.
So I tend to be, that's a in habit creation, like that's a trigger, not like triggered, but a trigger for me to be like, you know, you really have to have that. So I was just trying to figure out how you got, that question was really trying to figure out how you got to this quiet place, and you got to this quiet or a place that is quieter to recognize some of these other things through a lot of work. I remember giving a talk one time and this lady came up to me and she's like, I can tell you've done a lot of work on yourself. And I was like, I don't really know how to take that, but I'm going to take that as a compliment. But I think when people, and you have this about you, when people meet people that have that quiet confidence or calm about them, you recognize it. And it's not perfect, but there is some confidence in the belief and in what you're doing with tea reading and smoke reading. We can talk about these other things, is that you actually have confidence that what you see has meaning. And because you go with that gut, which is basically something in all of us that the brain doesn't have the way to use words to describe. That's right. Why everybody says gut, right? The brain can't describe what that is because it doesn't process that way. And you have gotten there. So it sounds like this is like decades of work.
It's not unlike that. You know, I don't think as a 25-year-old or 35-year-old, I would have confidently done tea leaf readings for anyone. And I didn't. I never even talked about it. Even though I knew how to read tarot cards my whole life, I never read them for anyone. I would read them maybe for myself. I would maybe pull out this deck and I would think of my grandmother and my mom holding these cards, and I would say, what's my card for today? Oh, it's this one. And I would just go about my day. But it was for me. It wasn't for anybody else. And to reach a place where I felt comfortable, A, delivering information, and B, trusting myself, and then also C, dealing with skeptics. I myself have been a skeptic. I have sat down at the table of various different kinds of readers, and they were so far off. I almost felt kind of bad. I went to get a tarot card reading once. I was with girlfriends, and there was a restaurant. They had a tarot card reader, and everybody's like, let's get it done. She actually didn't even know what the cards meant. She was kind of winging it. And I felt a little sympathy for her. You know, I thought she's probably just trying to pay her rent. But that said, anything like that is a skill that you have to learn. So, and sooner or later, you know, you will bump into someone who, if you're doing tarot cards, for example, who knows more than you, and that's okay. I mean, I am a legacy tarot reader, but I don't know everything. I've never drawn a tarot deck. There are people who draw their own, literally sit down and draw all 78 cards themselves with their own meanings and symbols. And you know what? I think that's great. Kudos to them for taking the time to do that work. I haven't done that. I can't say that I have plans to either. But for that, in tea leaf reading, when I decided to do it publicly, I practiced drawing. I wanted to deliver these drawings. I wanted them to be distinct and look good. So I tried different pens. I tried different paper. I made sure that I could do a good drawing of a squirrel, a good drawing of a whale, a good drawing that showed figures interacting, because I wanted to have the technical skills to go along with business skills to deliver a product to someone. I didn't want to be a fortune teller. I wanted to be an intuitive reader. And I think there's a difference.
Yeah. What is the difference between in your mind? Because okay. I see it. I can see it differently, but I'm interested for listeners for you to describe that.
So the fortune teller is the old cliche that developed in our society in the 50s and 60s. It is the probably gypsy. Some people say Roma now. Gypsy is no longer considered an okay word. And it is a Roma person who has big hoop earrings and they're wearing a bandana and they're gazing into a crystal ball and they're telling your future, usually. Perhaps they're reading your palm. Perhaps they are looking at a deck of tarot cards or regular playing cards. But they usually accompany a carnival. They're always in a dark spot. Sometimes they have curtains that are glittery. But this has become a cliche in our culture. And it probably started around, actually, I think the gypsy fortune teller, the Roma fortune teller, probably started in the Victorian era with the spiritualists. Because that's when the Roma people started telling fortunes for Europeans. And some of these cliches are because that's actually how they dressed or they actually lived in caravans. But it did become almost a joke in our society. And I don't necessarily do that. I don't live in a caravan. I show up wearing professional office clothing for my readings. And I practice my skills. I keep track of my business numbers. I do all the things that any other business person does when they're thinking about their business. I make marketing plans. I don't rely on anything other than actual business practices to run my business. And that said, an intuitive reader is someone who isn't necessarily there to tell you the future. I say that my readings show a mirror of where you are now, really, of what you're really going through, of what's really happening in your life. I'm always hesitant if somebody's asking me for the outcome of an event, because they can make one choice differently, or anybody else can, and pivot the entire situation. So I don't give advice like that. In some states, it's illegal, actually, to give advice like that. So that's important to know. This is part of running my business as a business person. So New York, Pennsylvania, Massachusetts, South Carolina, several others actually have fortune-telling laws on the books. You cannot predict the future for someone. But I know this because I run my business like a business. So that said, I don't tell people's fortunes. I give them a drawing. And in Smoke, I do a drawing as well. I give them a drawing of their reading, and it is a map of where they are in their life right now. It has split into two sides. There's a side about their emotional life and a side about their material life. And then at the very bottom, what the cup sees is what they hope for their future. And some people don't know. And it just shows up as nothing or just like some meaningless scattered tea. Other people, like this one, this person has really big hopes for their future. There's like fireworks in the middle. It's like, I hope that everything goes great and just positively explodes in my life. But not everybody's quite that optimistic. This person has a dog in the middle and they're just hoping for someone to be loyal. And that did reflect it truly in that person's reading because they had suffered a lot of betrayals in their personal life. So, that said, I do talk to people when I give their readings. A lot of times when I do remote readings, they're for people I don't know, and I'm just getting a set of pictures of their teacup, and I do the drawing, and then I meet them for the first time on Zoom.
What do you mean? Do they drink the tea when they show it to you in the camera?
They'll drink. No, I can't do it like that because people aren't good at lighting. Sorry, it's true. I also have a degree in photography. I know that people aren't good at lighting. But that said...
Well, now I'm very conscious of my
lighting. Your lighting is fantastic. You even have a catch light. It's very well done. So,
what light?
A catch light in your eye. So you can't see a catch light in my eye because I have glare on my glasses because I'm using natural light. And you have a catch light in your eye, like the little white sliver on the black of your eye, even through your glasses. So you have excellent lighting.
Oh my God. I'm so lucky. It was total luck, but go ahead. Sorry.
So yeah, I do still see things like a photographer, and I probably always will. But so that said, to do a remote reading, a person finds me, however they find me, honestly, usually from Instagram or YouTube, and they book a reading with me. They send me 5 to 6 pictures of their teacup 24 hours beforehand. I look at their pictures. I do their drawing. I usually know their name. Sometimes I don't even know that. I don't even always know where in the world they are. I do my best. And so I do their drawing and then I meet with them on Zoom and we talk for a minute and then I kind of jump into the cup because it takes me about an hour to walk through a full drawing. So when I do them on my YouTube, I try to finish them in under 15 minutes because it's YouTube and nobody hangs out that long. But a personal reading, I usually have a lot more interaction with them. We talk about the small micro symbols that I might not discuss on YouTube because who's going to sit and listen to me for an hour? But, you know, except like my mom. That said, a lot of times I have no idea who they are or what they're going through. I do have some people that are regulars, but I don't see anybody more than two times a year. That's my rule. I feel like it needs time to sort of play out. So if I gave you a reading that was like, say, this complicated, had this much in the teacup, like the drawing I'm holding up right now, there are dozens of symbols in there, big and small. And there are things that look like they're coming to an end in this person's world. And then there's going to be some upsets as well that are possible if they keep going the course. But that said, I would tell them, before you come back to me, wait 6 months. See how this goes. See how you feel and what your opinions are after that time. And then 6 months later, if you want another reading, we'll meet again. There are people who I see every 6 months, and there are people I see once a year, and that's enough for them.
This episode is sponsored by the Halle Financial Team at Expert Lending. Buying a house in today's market is competitive, and you need a lender that can close fast and get you the very best rate. The team is licensed in 48 states and has over 20 years experience in the real estate and lending space and access to lending rates that most mortgage brokers can't get. I know because I'm an investor in the team. If you need a mortgage or know someone that does, call or text Kara at 571-271-9086 and talk to a real human who will give you the customer service you deserve. Again, call or text Kara at 571-271-9086. 9086. Now back to the show. Do these readings show things that, do they reveal things that the person currently has that brings out recognition? Or I know you said you're not a fortune teller, and I understand, I think that's very smart because some people could get, I don't want to say it's not addiction. It's using
it addiction.
These. Oh,
is,
maybe, yeah.
People do get addicted to tarot readings, palm readings. I know other readers who have similar rules because there are people who try to come back every week.
And they probably try to use that as the map,
yeah.
Which then takes responsibility off of them, which then like totally ruins their life, basically.
And you know, when I'm looking at someone and they're dealing with a situation where they really should be speaking to a therapist, a psychologist, or they really should be speaking to a medical doctor or a physical therapist, lawyer, realtor, I say, you know, I think you need a realtor. You don't need a teacup reading. You should hire a realtor. You should hire a finance advisor. You should hire the right person. It's not me. So I think it's important to understand the limitations of any divination. It doesn't matter who's doing it or what they do or how amazing they are. If you need a doctor, you should go to a doctor.
So do you believe that there really is an energy? And here's the reason I believe that there's an energy in the universe that somehow, I describe it the way you do. I've just been lucky enough. I saw it once. I then kept recognizing it when it happened. And once you sort of, it's like what's that game? The Volkswagen Beetle thing.
When you drive,
yeah, right?
Yeah.
You see, it's like once you start looking for the Beetle bug, you see the Beetle bug everywhere. And, it, you know, or you look at the red car and now you see all these red cars. And it makes sense because your brain cannot and tries not to focus on many things at once because it's cognitively expensive. And that's why you're exhausted at the end of the day when you're task switching and doing all this crap. But so I can, and this just happened to me, not yesterday, day before, but I can think about someone. I know listeners would be like, wow, Brandon, I didn't really think about you this way because you seem like more of a logical person, but this could be logical and you may not just accept that yet because you're not open to accepting it. But I can think of someone that I haven't talked to in a while and I hesitate to say make, but I will hear from them. So I have a friend who is a lady. We've worked together in several different ways. We met through like an interesting way through a connection with my mom. that she went to school with at Yale, which is like really weird anyway, in this other setting that you just wouldn't get there that way. Anyway, I was like, oh, I have not heard from Kay in a while. Like, huh. And the next day I get a text from her. Now, it's just not, you could say, oh, that's one coincidence, but I can actually do, I can almost do that to people. Mm-hmm. Like, send that signal, or I'm either sending a signal or recognizing an intent ahead of time. And that sounds crazy. I understand that. I do understand. But I got to a point where what I realized is you can't use that power all the time because there's so much chaos in the world that you just can't control things that way. But you can occasionally, if it's not abused, direct it or recognize it or listen to it, and it happens. So do you think that that's a real thing?
Absolutely. And, you know, I will share with you that in journalism school and when I went to NYU, they taught us that coincidences do not exist. There's always a link. Just because you can't see it doesn't mean it's not there. In my years as a journalist, I remember interviewing, say, detectives, which as a journalist, you certainly interact with police detectives.
Especially in Baltimore.
Right? They'll tell you there's no coincidence on a case. You just have to figure it out and see if it's a relevant link to the case. So could coincidence exist? Maybe. But is it also possible that there's no such thing? I mean, it could be. It could be. I have talked to research scientists, when they find coincidences happen in the lab, they have to figure out why. Because they would again tell you there are no coincidences. That it's not a coincidence that this worked one time, but it didn't work the next. There has to be a reason. And it's possible, like you said, that we simply haven't reached a spot in understanding our brains yet that we see the reason. Energy connects us all. A physicist will tell you that right out of the gate, that energy is all around us. It's making up the microphones we're talking on, the sound that we're hearing, the light we're looking at. And I actually love talking about the physics of light, so I'll try not to get nerdy. But that said, I don't think that most people understand how energy works, because it's nobody really understands it, but they don't understand the everyday applications in which they're using the energy all the time, constantly. I mean, when we eat, our bodies turn food into fuel. That is our energy to get through the day. The light that is giving you that wonderful catch light right now, it's energy coming from a light. And I think it's kind of an amazing thing, the way all the different applications of the word energy. I mean, science is even starting to prove that acupuncture is real. For a long time, everybody thought acupuncture was not real. But there are definitely scientific studies that now prove for certain things, acupuncture is scientifically sound and helps with particular maladies more than it was ever thought before. All of that said, yes, I think that what you're experiencing is real. I can't explain it. I don't have a reason for it, and I don't have data to back it up. But I think it's absolutely real what you're experiencing. When you're thinking about an old friend and they text the next day, probably not a coincidence, especially because everybody has been there. We've all experienced similar things. And if you haven't, you're probably not paying attention.
Yeah, I think one of the, I don't know if it was the book, but the people sometimes ask me, because I'm more in business settings, I think they'll say, well, what is the best business book you would recommend? And I always recommend The Celestine Prophecies by James Redfield.
Oh, it's a great book.
And they are completely confused by that. And there's a lot of lessons in there. And I think early on in everyone's life, you're always searching. One is your brain isn't even fully developed. I mean, just biological fact until you're around 25. It differs for girls and boys, as you know. But like there's so many things going on. There's so many chemicals going on. And then you sort of get launched into quote unquote adulthood. And the world is so vast and the things are so chaotic and seemingly unpredictable and seemingly out of your control that I think most people are seeking, right? I mean, it's why colleges are generally more liberal and things like that, because that's where the exploration happens. But the James Redfield book, whether you believe it or not, the biggest lesson that I got out of that book was not that there is or isn't a coincidence, because like a lot of people argue with us around the world is random. There's no sense to it, whatever.
But free will determinism. People yeah, like arguing this, about that for millennia.
Right. Like, we're not going to get to a resolution. It's whatever you believe. And there is this thing called placebo effect. Whether you believe that or not is actually true. So whether acupuncture is real or not, I have no idea. But I do know that if you believe it's real, it is real, because those studies have gone on. But recognizing, and it changed my life, because I used to react, I think, to situations. My best example is the person who sits in the middle seat when you are on an airline and you're on the aisle. There's a person inside. The middle seat is open, and there comes that dreaded person who's like, oh, I'm sitting there. And everybody, I think, you're laughing for people not watching. But it's true. You're like, oh, shit. This is just effed my day. And I'm I'm not 6'5". I'm 5'8" on like a good day. So you get someone who's bigger, and then you're like, oh my God, they're encroaching in my space. I know listeners have experienced this, right? And that book changed me to say, well, why? What's significant about that person? So I learned to just change my state instantly. As soon as someone would sit next down to me, I'd be like, hey, where are you going? Are you coming or going? And all of a sudden, I've met these incredible people that I would have never met. I would have been angry for the most part, or annoyed, or whatever the right word is, agitated by that happening. And then that sort of went into life that I think I generally am a curious person. My wife, so happy, Risa, that I have a podcast, because I'm not allowed to ask questions after 11 at home because I asked too many. So I get to ask all these questions to you and all these other people, but just recognizing that. And that's a roundabout explanation to saying that you recognize the energy. But I do want to say one thing, going back to the horse example that we talked about, is that to validate your point that there's all of these forces happening that are actual facts that, for instance, if you have a lot of anxiety or hanging out with horses works mainly because the magnetic field from their heart lowers your heart rate to their heart rate. That's a fact. It's real science. They've done the studies on it, and it's because their heart is so big that that magnetic field, all of our hearts are giving off that magnetic field. Some people would suggest that it's too small to recognize. I would suggest that maybe someone like you who does these readings and things like that may be able to listen to that, to these signals, whether we, you, or whoever recognizes that that's happening. And just like the horse, you know, it's not a coincidence that your heart rate, as soon as you go hang out with a horse and you're close to the horse or grooming them or whatever, that your heart rate matches theirs.
Right.
So there's all these other things that are, there's this energy, and then there's actual energy. And maybe that other energy is the exact same thing as this magnetic field around a heart. It's just that we haven't figured out, or people don't recognize it.
You know, I think there's a lot we're still learning. The world is so infinite, and to believe that we get it all and we can explain it all is kind of as naive as me thinking one journalist is going to change a community. It doesn't make sense. And it isn't a livable ideal to think that you can figure it all out in one sitting, or that one person can. We all have to find our own way into understanding the world and being at peace with it or not. I mean, I guess you don't have to be if you don't want to be. You know, if you want to be angry at that person in the middle seat, that's your prerogative, of course. But I'm with you. I love meeting people and talking to people. And sometimes the person in the middle seat is me. If I get on late.
Well, if you check in earlier, yeah, you won't have to get that middle seat.
Yeah, so. I know it. But I've definitely been there before. And I'm really small. I'm 5'2 and about 110 pounds. So me in the middle seat is not a bad thing.
No, I would love, I'm looking for that. I'm eyeing those people as they come down the aisle.
So sometimes I take that as just a community kindness. But no, I've been on the aisle and or the window and had someone who was much bigger than me taking up the middle seat and making me feel pushed aside or, you know, like I had just shrink. So yeah, I understand what you're saying, but I also agree that it's a point of view and it's a choice. It's, have we chosen to see it that way?
Yeah, that's the lens. What would you say to people as I'm listening to our conversation? There could be some people out there thinking like, this is witchcraft.
Well, if they want to think that, go with whatever works for them, I guess. Witchcraft is something that's a pretty broad definition. And over time, that definition changes. So if they think that reading teacups is witchcraft, I'm not going to change their mind. It's totally fine if they want to think that. It doesn't affect me at all. I would say that a broad definition of witchcraft is any faith-based system that incorporates nature and that was historically older than every mainline religion that currently exists. And I've been on WYPR in Maryland talking about the history of witchcraft. So it's one of my areas of expertise you hit on. I actually think the history of witchcraft is more about the history of women and people of color than it is about spirituality. So I think that most people who cry witch today are stuck in an old superstitious pattern that there's actually not a lot of data for anymore or ever was, especially once the scientific method came to be. We learned to understand that witches weren't making boats sink. Witches weren't creating storms that killed crops. Those things weren't real. And sadly, thousands of people had to die for that. But again, if whatever people think is what they think, I'm not here to change anybody's mind. So I think that if fear and superstition are important to you, you should do what's good for you. I think that holding on to things like that, that are really old and I would say outdated ways of seeing the world, they can always be an option, but there's also a whole lot more to discover outside of superstition. So there's a whole lot more to see and experience in life without that. You know, get bold, adopt a black cat.
Do you think that that was, when you said it's more about women and people of color, that that was just an excuse to suppress women and people of color in history, and it was something that was more marketable?
Many historians think so, especially because right before the Hammer of Witches was published in Europe, they had the Hammer of Jews, and they went after Jews the same way they went after witches, but witches became broader. Anybody could be a witch, including a dog or a cat. You could, in Salem, they hanged two dogs. So you can go after anybody as a witch. You can't go after just anybody and say they're Jewish. So it became simply put, it was a system of control. It was a system of control used by those in power, all kinds of those in power, not just spiritual people, not just certain religions, but everybody. And it created a culture of fear around women and people of color and anybody who's different than the mainline community. So it's a rather unfortunate chapter in humanity's history, but I would say that it does still play a role today. It does still echo out. And there are probably people that practice nature-based faiths that still experience that kind of, what's the word? It's not racism. It's, help me out here. What's the word I'm looking for?
I don't think it's racism. I talk about this with my wife, Yvette, all the time. I think it's more stereotypes, or I think there's this thing called, the analogy that I use is my wife does dog agility and she does small dogs in general. We've always had Jack Russells. Mm-hmm. We have a poodle, a mix Jack Russell Terrier, and we still have another Jack Russell. But small dog people will talk about breed. Let's just breed people will talk about other breed people differently. And that's just, humans are pack animals.
Yes.
Humans in general are not soloists. It doesn't mean that someone can't be. There's always several standard deviations from the norm where these things, people, animals, circumstances exist, and they're fine. But in general, humans do that. So we segment all the time. Mm-hmm. We segment blonde and brunettes, men and women. We segment, you're from Baltimore. My whole life is defined by where I went. I don't mean this like it's this bad thing. Or in Baltimore, for listeners, and you'll understand this, when they ask you where you went to school, they are not asking you your college, your master's, or your PhD. They are asking you what high school you went to. And that is how you, it's not good or bad. It's just, that's how we in Baltimore segment who you are, right? I mean, am I right?
Absolutely. I've 100% heard that happen. And if a transplant like me and I went to school, high school in Pennsylvania, they just kind of look at me like, you don't actually belong here.
It's a weird thing. Like, all I have to do is say, I went to BL. I went to Boys Latin.
Mm-hmm. And, I know what that means.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Everybody. And you know what that means because it is a symbol going back to your world. Mm-hmm. These are symbols that humans make because we need to segment, because we are trying to make sense of a world that is very hard to make sense of. And I think what has happened in society is they've made, as I'm listening to you, I was like, oh my God, we could just talk about the pandemic and the whole use of witchcraft marketing, which was used to control many people. I don't care what side you're on this conversation, because you can look at it from both lenses. Mm-hmm. And they both have validity, but humans are just always trying to segment. It's like, can you imagine going through a world where you can't segment things and there's total chaos? We'd be neurotic and crazy, right?
Right.
I mean, it happens in, you know, I'm using Maryland and Baltimore because that's where you're from and where you live and where I was originally. Like, it's like saying, oh, I'm from Hunt Valley, or I'm from Towson, or I'm from Harford County, or I'm from Dundalk, or I mean, all these, they're not just places, they're symbols. Perry Hall, mm-hmm. Fork, Falston, like I can keep going, Roland Park, all these things are bringing things to our mind, Federal Hill, right? Like just keeps, I could keep on going down the list, and Annapolis, Easton, Ocean City. These things are eliciting feelings and we attribute these things. So that was back to your question. I elaborated on it because I find it, people use that word. You said, what word did you use? You said they're racist. They're not racist. This isn't racism. Like, I don't fundamentally believe that the majority of people really believe that their race is better than another. I think they're segmenting to a, I mean, I'm not saying that they don't. Some people obviously do, and they're a little, that's extreme. But most people describe a situation where people are segmenting themselves as racist when it's really not racist. It's really common traits among those groups. And they're taking that to such an extreme mm-hmm. that there's no willingness to accept people. I hope that people accepted you in Baltimore, because in general, I found that we do segment by high school, but we always welcome outsiders into that way in a really unique way that you almost get defined by the people who are the majority of the people who went to that high school. It's how it sort of happens.
That's very true. And, you know, I wanted to add one other thing to your original question about divination and witchcraft. I would offer that every time anybody flips a coin, they are practicing divination. So if the person flipping a coin at the beginning of any sporting event is practicing witchcraft, then so am I. And if they're not, then neither am I. And I'm okay with whatever people think about that.
That is a very good no-win situation for the other person analogy, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, it really is. It's luck, whatever luck is.
Which is also something very hard to define.
Well, yeah. What do you think about luck?
I think it's in the eye of the beholder, honestly. I think there are situations that even when they first happen, we think are very unlucky. And then a year later, we might be like, thank God that happened. I am in a totally different place now. Or something that seems lucky might not be, or maybe it is. But it can be really tricky to know if you are actually lucky or not until you live through it.
So let's go back to tea leaf reading and smoke.
I have the cup ready. Would you like me to turn it for you?
Yeah, that'd be great.
Okay. So this process is super not fancy. I have the saucer here.
Mm-hmm.
I'm putting a paper towel in it so that the cup doesn't scratch. And then I'm going to put it on the teacup like a hat, like this.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'm going to swish it, which you won't see on camera because I need a little more space. So I'm swishing it around in a circle.
Does it still have tea in it?
It has a little bit of tea in it. And now I'm inverting the cup. So from here, I pull it up and you see all the grounds on the inside.
Oh my God, that looks very confusing. That is a lot of tea leaves, man. You must have a very, very, is that decaf?
No, not at all.
You got jacked up for this episode.
Oh, I usually drink one cup of black tea a day, but no more. Okay. This is Earl Grey tea and I think there's nothing here that I'm going to be able to show you on camera because as you can see, most of the symbols are really little here.
Okay. So you could describe them though, because just for listeners, mm-hmm. I don't see any symbols. I see like big blobs.
You see a big mess of tea. That's what most people look at it and see as well. The first thing I see underneath the handle, I always start underneath the handle because
are you reading this for yourself today?
No, I didn't actually pull it with any intention. I was just kind of telling you a few things that I see in it.
Okay.
I always start at the handle because that's where people hold it when they drink it. So that's kind of where I begin story. The first thing I see is a person running away from their emotional world. And that doesn't actually define me. I have been spending a lot of time in my emotional world lately. But if I were reading this for someone, that's the first thing I would see. There is a human figure. They are dashing into their material world as if they're much happier in the world of things than they are in the world of feelings. The next thing down is a rabbit. So rabbits are one of those symbols with a lot of meanings because culturally they have meanings. So like in the Chinese astrology, it could be someone born under the year rabbit or the rabbit meaning the good fortune and good luck. In common superstition, rabbits are also about good luck. So to me, a rabbit is about something new beginning. And this is going first into the emotional side of the cup. I like to start there because I feel like our emotions color how we see our world. No matter how good or bad, technically, things are in your world, depends on how you see it. So I always read the emotional side of the cup first, even though this one is mostly big stuff in a material side. There's all kinds of cool things going on the material side. There is actually a huge tree. So whoever this cup would be for, if it was actually somebody's cup, I would say that they've been working for a long time on a project and it's finally starting to really do something. It's finally lifting off and they are leaning against the tree as if they're still trying to hold it up. But what the situation might be is that it might be okay for them to step away and let their business opportunity stand on its own, that they don't need to keep pushing quite so hard. So anyway, that's a few of the symbols in that cup.
What else is in that cup? I'm interested to see if it's manifesting itself through our conversation.
So there is a gap in this cup. And when I have an opening like this, I always read it as the person is in a situation of transition. They have left one part of their, in this case, emotional life, and they're moving on to the next. So there's an opening. There's this opportunity or gap in the cup for new emotional things to come in. So that is usually defined as relationships, friendships, things like that. If they have a family, it might be that they're starting a new phase in the family. Like maybe the kids are leaving elementary school and going to middle school kind of thing. And there's one little dinosaur here. So I always read dinosaurs as things from the past that you haven't resolved and they're still walking along with you. So this dinosaur is kind of sitting. This dinosaur is kind of sitting and looking out lazily. It's not interested in moving. It kind of wants to stick around. So it could be someone or a situation from the past that this person is simply not willing to let go of, even though they might not be the best. And I'm looking now for what it's linking to, like what other symbols are around it. Probably someone who was a romantic interest. There is an upside down heart. It is someone who turned their love upside down and they're still holding on to this whole situation. I would warn people in this case, if I was reading this cup for a client, I would say, don't repeat the pattern. If you have the option, don't repeat an unhealthy pattern just because it's familiar. Keep looking for possibly something a little better and brighter in other partnerships. Yeah, I don't see this being about our conversation so much as just a random cup. In their material world, where almost all of the information lies in this cup, the biggest thing I saw, the most important thing, was a tree, with the person still trying to hold it up when it doesn't need it anymore. It's obviously growing on its own, and that's absolutely delightful. So some of the other symbols here. The person who is running away from their emotions and toward their material life, it makes sense, the tree, because obviously they want to focus on their work. They don't necessarily want to focus on changes in their emotional life. They don't want to commit time to that. There's a large windmill on this side as well, in the material side. It means that in their business life, there's some inevitable change coming, and they probably know about it. When I look at a windmill, I always see it as like the natural turn of things, not so much an unexpected change as is a change they want or have been working for. So in this case, that's on the way. It won't disturb the tree, but it will blow off the old leaves. There's also a submarine over here, which I don't see a ton of. It kind of tells me that in their business or even in their home life, there is going to be a big thing that comes along, and they might already be anticipating it because a submarine, it's not always a surprise. There's a big thing coming along that they're going to have to deal with it. And it's attached to a bunch of other smaller figures. I usually do this with a magnifying glass, because these symbols are tiny.
Wow.
That's why I was telling you this can take like a whole hour.
Oh, I'm just interested in it. I think people will be interested in it. This is a preview of what you could get, right?
Sort of, kind of.
What do you?
It's harder when I'm reading for no one. There's no one to.
Well, how do we know that you're not? How do you know that you're not reading for yourself? You drank that tea.
Oh, I did, but I normally, when I'm reading, first of all, I don't always read for myself. In fact, not very often. I can't do it without bias.
True.
And if I feel like I need a reading, I will probably go to someone else for one. I don't have a lot of other tea leaf readers that I can call on. I only know two others. But Wow. Yeah, there's not a ton of us around. It's despite Harry Potter making it popular, it's just not out there that much. Most people don't have the patience for it. I've taught it to many, many people, and as far as I know, none of them have picked up the practice over time. Mm. So, okay. This is my Sherlock Holmes style spyglass here. Ah, that's much better. Okay, so in this cup, the person who's running away from their emotional world, they are running towards a bunch of other smaller symbols immediately hitting within the beginning of the cup. There is a fish. I always read the fish in the Chinese symbology way, especially on the material side. It's about money. They're chasing after money, not so much after people in their life. They are much more interested in stability in their business, in their work. They aren't necessarily wanting to deal with things in their emotional world. And I'm going to guess that is probably because of this past heartbreak. There are a bunch of really little symbols along this one edge, and there's all kinds of stuff here. There is a turtle. Turtles are about the changes that you want happening very slowly. And it is sitting on a partnership symbol. So even though they might perhaps have this dinosaur with the upside down heart, they don't want a new partnership. They haven't really let go of the old situation, and they're kind of just sitting still in it. And there's maybe even some stuckness around that.
Can I ask a question while you're doing this?
Of course.
What happens if someone says, He said, that's not true. That's not me. What you just say, okay.
I mean, like, I'm willing to be wrong, but right. Often people will say that and then they'll step back and be like, okay, maybe you're actually right, but I don't want to deal with that. Or I don't want to talk about that. Or I don't want to acknowledge that. And sometimes the upside down heart and the dinosaur, I'm saying it's a romantic relationship because a heart is usually about a romantic relationship. But sometimes then I'll read the small symbols around it and they'll be, I don't know, a sewing machine. And it's actually about their troubled relationship with their mother who loves to sew. And in those cases, if they don't want to talk about it, we don't have to. I still will read what's in their cup. And I usually do the drawing first and then this part. So normally I wouldn't read straight from a cup like this. I would do the drawing and then we'd go through it like that. But I mean, this is just as the same. It's the same. But if somebody doesn't want to talk about something, that's fine. If I'm wrong, I'm willing to look again and see what the symbols are around a larger piece. Because saying something from the past is bothering you is really general. What matters are the pieces around it that define it. And I would say that figuring out who that is and how it's reflecting on their lives is more what the cup is about. So I'm looking for that heart. I'm looking for that sewing machine. I'm looking for the things that tell me who is the person that is the one sort of slowing down their interest in their emotional world and that they're focused instead on money and business growth. And that's literally in this cup where all of the effort is.
So this has really given me a deeper appreciation. I say this lovingly, not that I was a skeptic, of course, but because I clearly believe in energy in the universe and being in touch with that. It's sort of like this, not struggle, this internal debate, right? Like, oh, that wasn't a coincidence. I can do that. I know there's energy around this. But what it feels like is a much deeper therapeutic exercise. And because, so you are clearly in touch with something because there's no way you guess Sasquatch or a Bigfoot. I think Bigfoot's a cooler word, but I don't think you guess Bigfoot. Maybe it's regional. I don't know. In Maryland, we always call it Bigfoot. I think it's much like you're not going to guess Bigfoot, and you're not going to, was it an iguana or salamander?
Yeah, I literally thought they were wrong, but I decided to say what I saw.
Right. So that's super hard. Those things are not coincidences. And I'm sure you could rattle off a whole bunch more that you've read and that are right. So let's take that separately. But what you are really doing, and I think the person has to come with an open mind. If they come as a skeptic, they probably still get caught in that introspection because some of the things you've said in there, I could say, well, I can see that in myself. And what it really does is it makes the other person start to look within themselves without you saying, with me on the couch, hey, Brandon, this is what you should be doing. Or like, it's almost as if this third party thing allows an opening into someone that they're more receptive to receiving because it's not that person telling them something, which humans in general aren't good with, right? Like, I mean, so it feels very much like equine therapy to me in that you're reading the symbols that you do see, and that person has to figure out how that or does or doesn't apply to them. But most likely, like you said, I would bet you more often than not, the person comes in and says, the skeptic, let's take the skeptic who walks in and says, you said, that's just like, everybody has that. You're just guessing. That thing doesn't say anything. And then they probably 3 days later, 2 days later, or that night when they put their head on the pillow, say, oh shit, if they're being honest, I was shutting that off because I don't want to deal with it. I mean, I would be open to the fact that there could be recurring themes in all humans' lives, going back to our story of everybody has a sad story, been hurt, had something, I don't want to say traumatic. we've all been like, we're human, like life happens. There's all these things, like things happen, whether you're rich, poor, whatever, green from another planet, what it just happens. And this exercise allows you to do the person that you're doing the reading for to start to do the work on themselves through something that doesn't feel attacking, judgmental,
right,
or whatever, because you're just reading what the tea leaves say.
And they walk away with a drawing that is their memory of the event. I let people take recordings if they want to, but
really, mm-hmm. Like video?
No, just sound. Nobody needs to watch a video of me talking. But
we're recording this, so people on YouTube watch it.
Well, yeah. This is a little different. It's an interview, but
it's not an interview. That's probably why it is different, right?
That's true. But I mean, if somebody really wanted a video, when I do the Zoom readings, I do allow people to have the video recording if they want it. So yes, I guess sometimes video. Nobody in person has ever asked to take a video.
I'm just asking. I don't know.
Yeah. But I think that I was sitting here remembering a reading I did last weekend, and a young woman came into me. I had never met her. I didn't even know her name. And within 3 minutes of looking at her cup, I strongly felt from what I was looking at that she had just suffered a death in the family. So I said, "Have you suffered a recent loss?" And she said, "Yes." "How did you know that?" And I'm not going to say that everybody who comes into me looks sad. That's not true. People come into me in all states of mind. I could intuit that her mood was down, but for all I know, she had trouble parallel parking, which is also a thing. But
are you in Ellicott City?
Actually, I live in Elkridge, but I work in Ellicott City.
Elkridge. Yeah. Elkridge. Okay. Well, parking in Ellicott City is a disaster, but anyway.
It is pretty bad. They did add some new lots, but it hasn't helped. But I guess it helped a little. Token effort. But I could tell from the symbols in her cup that she'd suffered a recent loss. And I could tell that I kind of knew it was her dog. And so when I asked, it was a dog in the cup. I could see what was going on. It was huge. It was occupying every thought in her mind that her dog was gone. And so I simply asked, "Is this where you are? Have you suffered a recent loss?" And she said, "Yes, 2 days ago." And I said, "Allow me to guess, was it an animal friend?" And she said, "Yes." So that changed. It did change how I looked at the rest of her cup, because we were having that interaction. So like, this was a cup for nobody, but when somebody reads, I'm reading a cup for a purpose, you know, if somebody has a question, we'll frequently address their question, but not in the way they expect. So the most common, you're not going to be surprised to hear this. The most common two questions I get are about people's romantic lives and their money. And the cups don't always answer these questions directly. And a lot of the questions about romantic lives are deal with yourself before you look for a new partner answers. And a lot of the money questions are answered with, you know, what are you doing to change the thing that you want to change? Are you just complaining, or are you actually taking active steps to improve your financial life? And nobody really loves hearing either of those answers. I'm not going to lie. Sometimes I feel like I'm giving people tough love, but you're right. It's coming from me. I'm a stranger. I'm incredibly calm and approachable, and it's not like it's coming from their family or their colleagues or a therapist. All of those have a very different feeling.
So I'm looking at your profession from a higher level. I think that fortune tellers and these people, tarot card readers, some of them are scam artists, and they made a bad name for the industry. And I think that people who don't understand this, which I wanted to talk to you. I was like, I'm going to figure this out, right? I'm curious about this whole thing. I think that people that become judgmental or come in with this preconceived notion that Risa is a fortune teller or can read my situation or she's going to get it wrong is actually missing the whole point.
Well, you know, they're also wasting money. I don't know why you would.
They might be missing. Here's the irony. They might be wasting money, but they're still doing it.
Yeah.
So there's some sort of attraction that's I don't know what animal or symbol that is, but that's their their inability to actually, they may be scared mm-hmm. that you actually may say something true. I would argue that that is the anxiety.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember my wife, now wife, we've been together, I think 27 years, but when we first started dating, we went to New Orleans early on. It was one of our first trips. And she's like, oh, let's do a tarot card reading. I was like, I don't want that. This is bullshit. I don't even want to deal with this. And the truth is probably looking back on it now to my 25-year-old self was just a fear that I was already dealing with being in grad school, starting a company that I didn't even know what the hell I was doing, to be honest. I was excited. It wasn't negative. These are positive things, but mm-hmm. I've got...
Dresser.
Yeah. Like I got another job. I got another job that I got to pay the person that I hired to work in the company. So I had all these other things. And Yvette wants to go into this reading that's going to like throw a whole bunch of other shit on me that I just don't want to deal with. And I think I'm just processing this all, our conversation, because I think it's important for listeners to, it's not a witchcraft. It's not, I'm not saying that everybody thinks that. It's not this, or mystical. You could see it as mystical because you're not in, the person isn't in touch with the signals that you have been able to be in touch with. But it's actually like real therapy that you can really figure some shit out. But it's not going to be easy. Like no. you're not going to always read the tea leaf that I would argue that there is a pot of gold at the end of the rainbow for everyone. You have to figure out how to get all the blockers and all of your perceptions out of the way to get there. But everybody has the opportunity. I understand that some people aren't born this into a better situation or an easier route. But at least in America, the path is generally there. And I bet you we could find examples of almost any ethnicity, whether they are born in the United States or not. And I can think about that for Yvette's family, who she's a first generation person in the United States, and her dad came here with $5 and, you know, becomes this custom jeweler in Beverly Hills. He walks down Rodeo Drive. He's retired now, but everybody knows his name. Like, there's just so many opportunities for people, but most of those things are just blockers. And I don't mean to make this I don't mean to make your profession a science or like psychology, but it actually really is.
There's definitely that element to it. I usually describe myself as a divination artist, not just because I draw, but because I think of it as a creative medium that takes some skill as well. So if you want to be an oil painter, you also need skill. You can't just decide to do it. You have to decide to do it and practice and learn perspective and learn brushstroke and learn beautiful blending technique. There's skill as well as artistry involved.
I agree. And you said it better than I could say. That's, I think, what I'm trying to articulate is that this is not just this magical thing. It actually is a skill. Mm-hmm. It's like being a photographer, which is now lost, but maybe it's not with Photoshop, but being a photographer and be able to understand how to do screening in the darkroom and what a screen can do to that picture mm-hmm. that changes that image inherently. Mm-hmm. And that is a skill where some people would say, oh, you just frame the picture, you snap the shot. Well, there's more to it than in being a photographer. There's the darkroom. I think the darkroom has been replaced with, can you be really good in Photoshop?
Yes.
And these other things to understand the nuances that there's a shadow here and what color that shadow would be. So I think people did that in the darkroom. But yeah, I think there's way more skill to this. And I think, as with all professions, that it's the people who take advantage of that make any industry have a bad name, because you see the tarot card readers at the ocean all the time. And I have a hard time, respectfully, believing that some of them on the boardwalk are legit. I think it.
I don't know them all. I do know plenty of other intuitives. Some are very ethical. And I have returned people's money when I couldn't do a reading for them. I have had people sit down. I'm pretty sure they were either skeptics or they just didn't want to be there and they got a gift certificate. And I said, look, I'm giving you the money back. I can't read for you. in those cases, usually when they pull their cup up, there's no tea in it. It's all on the napkin. And if that happens two times, that's like, I'm giving you your money back. We're done here. I can't read you.
Do they feel rejected though?
I don't know. I've never followed up with anyone. I won't answer some questions. I have had people sit down and ask me things like, what is the outcome of my court case going to be? I can't ethically answer that question. I can't ethically answer questions like, will I survive my cancer treatment? I can't answer that. It's not an ethically okay thing for me to do. So I think there are readers that are ethical, and I think there are readers who are not, just like in any other professional field. There are people who are ethical and there are people who aren't.
Yeah. I mean, I didn't really think about the complication with that, but that is complicated, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, you can't answer those questions. And I think some people do attempt to answer those questions. But how does the smoke work the same way? Like, how's the smoke work?
It's a little different. And I either use incense or candles. And in our modern world, candle science has evolved that nice candles have smokeless wick. So I need to find, to even start, I have to find a candle like this one that is, what's the word?
Crappy.
Of the right nature to still have smoke. So this one does blow out smoke. I have a whole bunch of extras because I can't always find them. And smokeless wicks definitely change smoke reading. But smoke reading is actually even older than tea leaf reading. It goes back to ancient civilizations used to do it. It was only done by royalty and high priests and priestesses. It was done at Delphi. And it was kind of a lost art. I was taught by another diviner to do it. And I have a system where people still get a drawing. So I use the candle. I don't look while I'm making the drawing. It's a very different looking piece of art. And I let the soot from the candle collect on a piece of paper. And
how does that happen?
Well, I can show you, but
we'll describe it for listeners.
I can't actually light this on fire in here, just in case there would be a fire. So the other thing that's important to remember is if you want to gaze into smoke, you can't have interference from like vents and open windows. And you have to have a dark background. Like there's a black background behind me. That's a good background for looking at smoke. If you are just trying to look in an open room, you can't see it. So
you also need even temperature in the room.
You do, or it affects the smoke. Because a lot of people imagine me doing it outside by the fire, you know, in this very rustic native feeling. And, you know, I'm sure it has historically been done that way, but it's not a very controlled situation. And you're more reading the weather than you're reading the smoke. So I don't read outside. I can tell you how windy it is or isn't, if that's the case. So I use the candle, I light it, and then I hold a piece of paper above it, and I just allow the soot to collect. Mm. I move it around at random. I don't look at it. It only occasionally has caught on fire. The two times that happened, the candle and the page were about that far apart, and somehow the candle flame leapt. I don't know what caused it to spark, but both times I was over a tile floor and there was no problem.
I just say, hey, listen, you're screwed. I'll give you your money back. I'm just kidding.
You know, I did tell both clients, your page caught on fire. So let's talk about what that could mean for your life right now. And in both cases, they were in the middle of crises. And it made sense in the situations where that happened. So this is what the soot collection.
Can I ask you a quick question about that? Uh-huh. How many people do you think are really in the world that aren't going through some crisis at the moment?
I guess that depends on your perspective on what a crisis is.
I mean, crisis is a dramatic word, but like, how many people are like,
everybody's struggling with something.
There you go. Yeah. I mean, right? I mean,
everybody's struggling with something, and nobody reaches out to me if things are great. I pretty much assume if somebody's going to reach out to me for a reading that there's something on their mind that's troubling them and they are trying to manage some risk associated with it. That's why they find me. they don't find me because their life is super happy and they want to know how to sustain it. I have yet to field that question. I would love to field that question. It hasn't
happened. That's a good thing though. Like, hey, it's going really well. How do I keep this going?
I would love to do that reading. It hasn't happened yet.
All right. So you're back to the smoke reading. You hold the paper just high enough.
I hold it up above and I never know what it's going to look like, but this is what a soot collection looks like.
Oh my God.
And then I gaze into it and look for symbols just like I do a teacup.
Looks like a poodle to me.
I bet, because you have one. You see what you know, right?
Right.
And I basically will look at this and intuit the shapes, read them like I do the symbols in a teacup. And I seal that drawing then with art spray and I send it to them at the end of the reading. But it actually takes me usually a little longer to read smoke than it does to read tea, just because of the nature of how soot collects. I'm not in control of the drawing. So it's a slightly different process. Does that make sense?
It completely makes sense. That's why I asked. I wanted to understand the difference between it. So how do you clear your mind? Because you just made it's all about the lens of which you see the world.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you clear your mind from that? Like, I don't know, it's later in the afternoon there. It's 3:10.
Yep.
Like, how do you clear your mind from everything that just went on this morning to make sure that what you're seeing isn't what
is in my world?
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm very mindful about not putting myself into my readings. And there have been a few times where I thought I saw something in a cup that I'm like, I stopped. I sort of shook my head, closed my eyes and looked again. And I thought, okay, this reading isn't for me. I know that it is for someone else. And it's very possible that my last dog was a greyhound, that the greyhound would not be relevant for them. So a greyhound is relevant for me. So I step back and I look again. And if I still see a greyhound, I go with it. And sometimes it does make sense to them. And other times I look again and it's not a greyhound at all. It's something.
You look
totally
like a greyhound
different.
Person.
What's that?
You look like a greyhound person. Greyhounds are very restful, but extremely fast. Ironically, right?
Yeah.
That's the irony of the greyhound. But yeah.
Yeah. I have had two greyhounds and one galgo. So yeah. I do love my sight hounds. I've had other dogs too, but they have been my most recent companions.
Yeah, I can admit they are very calm and they will rest.
They will rest, but they will also be active.
Rabbit or something, you better hold on.
Yeah, they will be active, especially the galgo was a much better walking companion than my greyhounds. The greyhounds were kind of like 2 miles and we're done. The galgo would go 5 to 7 miles and be done.
Wow.
So yeah.
So you basically clear your mind before this. I have, do you do the Ouija board at all? Like, is that thing, I mean, isn't that thing sort of like controlled by the person anyway, subconsciously?
I don't mean to laugh at your question.
Why?
I think Ouija boards are the most feared piece of cardboard in America. I don't understand.
Because of Jumanji, right?
Not Jumanji. It was The Exorcist. In The Exorcist, before The Exorcist, they were legally determined in the 1920s to be a toy. Yeah. Somebody took it to court in Maryland.
Oh, didn't somebody in Baltimore?
Yes, Elijah Bond, an attorney.
A lawyer.
Yes, he was a lawyer. Elijah Bond from Baltimore created and patented the Ouija board. It was made in Baltimore until 1966.
Yeah,
and in the 1920s, it was taken to court. Is this a way to summon the devil? And a court of law determined the Ouija board was just a game. And so it became a spirit board. It was a common household object for a very long time until we get The Exorcist. So The Exorcist was a movie. It was at the front of the satanic panic movement in the United States, right? And suddenly the Ouija board becomes a way to summon demons. It's never been a way to summon demons before, but now it is thanks to The Exorcist, and people are terrified of this piece of cardboard. I find it incredibly amusing. If you sit and think it out, it doesn't make any sense at all. Why would a demon who could control people who are powerful and rich care about a piece of cardboard? I don't know.
Because it was more than that. I've been scared of the Ouija board since I was a kid. My grandmother was like a mystic. She's like an energy reader, my mom's mom. And she had some like amazing powers. But and people would seek her out. Mm-hmm. She used to have a thrift store out in Moncton area, and people would
go
to
her. Oh, that's fascinating.
her thrift store. It's like this whole mystic thing. And they go see Vera, and she taught us all these things. Like, I grew up with, what do you call it when you read like different wavelengths during the month? Cycles are not rhythms. Yeah. What is it called? Where people, you could read your biorhythms.
Biorhythms. Okay.
All right. So she was like into biorhythms, energy, the Ouija board. I remember her. She's like, this is a very powerful, mystical thing.
It's a tool
that can answer questions. And I can remember my brother and I, we were little, being like, oh shit, stay away from the Ouija. Like, don't even met. This was like, we didn't even like sneak and get the Ouija board and screw around with it because it was so scared that it would like do something, right? And she would say, this thing's going to move around. And it's like, oh man. So that's why I asked about the Ouija board. But
yeah. So I don't have a Ouija brand board. I have this, it's a wooden board. I mostly just have it around as a decor item because I think it's really pretty. It has all
You don't use that ever?
It's not a tool that I use. I have plenty of other tools that I'd rather use. Tea is my first love. I would rather use a teacup. If I'm looking for information from intuition, that works better for me. There is that element of trust with a Ouija board. If you're using it with someone else, you have to implicitly trust that they're not purposefully moving it, that they are allowing their intuition to guide it and not their desire for a certain answer. Because, you know, you have these yes-no answers, you know, and I mean, if you want a yes, no answer question, you can always flip a coin, but back to that simple divination. But I've never used one alone. I have never tried to seriously use one as a divination tool. I think there probably are people who can. I haven't personally encountered them. And I mean, I think that if you are in touch with your intuition enough that any tool that you decide to make work for you is the one that will work for you. And if that happens to be a tarot deck, maybe that will work for you perfectly. If it happens to be tea, that's fine. If it is a spirit board like this, that's fine. There are other people who don't need any tool at all, and they get into whatever flow it is and find information. I don't know how they do that, but there are people who do. And there are all kinds of readers and intuitives that use all kinds of tools. I don't think it has to be a traditional fortune teller's tool like a Ouija board. I think that it is a personal way of seeing and being that creates the intuition.
How much does it cost?
I charge $125.
For a reading. Then you get the reading, you get the event with you, and you get the...
The drawing.
Yep. The drawing that you do. Well, that's pretty cool. And people can do that online and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Do they come to your, do you have an office?
I don't. I prefer to go to other people. I've had small businesses before, and I'm not super interested in having a storefront anymore. But I will go to different, I will meet them at different places in Maryland, Pennsylvania, Delaware, or they can meet me online. I've actually had people hire me to come to New York and other places as well. So I will travel within reason. And I guess...
And you charge for that.
They have to pay for my travel and accommodations and travel time.
Yeah, of course. I mean, I can imagine that. And you're doing this full time.
I know. I still do this part time. I still write and edit. And I love doing that too. And I honestly am not quite ready to give it up.
What do you write now? Do you do books or articles or...
So I just transitioned away from working for a magazine as their senior editor, and I am moving into, I can't tell you the author's name, but I'm moving into ghostwriting for someone else right now. And I will probably fulfill that contract by sometime next year. And then I will see if I want to keep writing in that way or not. I'd love to finish one of my own novels. I think I have 4 started and they're all at different points of completion. It would be lovely to finish one of my own. And then we'll see, I guess.
Yeah, writing's I just finished this really simple book that I thought was going to be simple. It was super hard. And
it's a project, taking on a book of any length.
Well, my goal, and you can appreciate this, is my goal was to write a business book on how to write a business plan from a course that I've taught about 1,500 students over the course of when I've done this. And my goal was to actually not hit this 60,000. I know novels are larger,
mm-hmm.
but it was not to hit the 60,000 words. It was to actually make it as short as possible. It came in,
under
23,000, 23,000 words. I think it's actually like the actual book is probably content is 22,000. There's other stuff in there. And I did it, but it was, you know, I really thought so that I was going to pump this out, be done with it in 3 months. And it didn't happen. Now, luckily, I don't know when this is coming out, so I'll say it, but we did a stealth launch. Mm-hmm. I screwed up. I did a pre-launch and I should have done a stealth launch. So I switched, but we already were in the top of the charts in Amazon, like top 10 in the beginning. And then I have a hard copy and paperback. But like this whole process has been and my intent is to write a whole series, Back of the Napkin 2, business plan, pitch deck, marketing plan, life plan. Most people, I realized, Risa, have no idea how to do a personal budget. So if I told...
Well, it's not actually, at least I was never taught that. And I've had a lot of education.
No, yeah, me too. I mean, I don't know how many... I have 2 master's degrees and postgraduate work at another school with psychology and certifications. And I was never taught the home budget, the mortgage, the insurance, like... And it's actually ironically, I don't want to go off topic because we're talking about writing, and I'll tell you what really motivated me in a second. But I lost my train of thought. But I got motivated because I had this. I'm going to call her a girl because she was a girl when I had her on the show. Now she's a young woman, but she was last year or a year and a half ago, 14 years old. She had written 7 novels already.
That's amazing.
And I just talked to her. She's my quote unquote, air quote, coach. And now she told me the other week or two ago that she has 21 novels. She's 15 years old.
Does she also go to school?
Yep, she does. She has this writing thing down. She's extremely, clearly. I mean, she amazed me. And
talk about focus. Like,
yeah, she has a writing coach. She gives me all the tips. I mean, she told me how to, you know, she's like, don't get a publisher. Don't waste your time. Self-publish. The publisher will pick you up after you have 2 or 3 books because they're going to want you if your book is decent and get some sales.
That's the general knowledge of the industry now. Yeah.
Which is sort of crazy, right? It's changed. I mean,
dramatically.
Well, some of the publishers were interested because one of the podcasts with at the time 300 plus episodes, which is a lot of episodes. Mm-hmm. I've got an email list of over 24,000 people, which most people don't have. And then when I was talking to the publishers, I was like, well, what are you going to give me? And they're like, oh, we're going to market it. And I was like, how are you going to market it? Tell me how you're going to market it. Give me your marketing plan right now. And they just didn't have really good answers. And they were going to take most of my ownership of it away. So yeah, I was like,
that's the thing too.
Right. I was going to, and I've hesitated asking you this, but since we're talking about journalism, you said that as a journalist, you're skeptic. Mm-hmm. You would be a natural skeptic, but as a journalist, wouldn't you just be curious?
That too. But you're taught to, depending on what kind of journalism you're doing. I mean, if you're doing food writing, it's a little different than being in hard news, right? So, and I've done both. So I would say that as a journalist, you're taught to keep pushing and digging. You're taught to keep asking questions. You're taught to, especially when you're doing hard news, you are taught to continually look for the deeper answer, the more. And you want to answer, obviously, all those simple journalism questions, who, what, why, when, where, how. And honestly, those questions, as simple as they sound, people aren't always forthcoming with them. And you learn to just keep digging until you find everything, if everything is doable to find. And I think that one of the practices of journalism that stayed with me was looking for the answer under the answer. And that's not a natural match with divination of any kind, because sometimes the answer under the answer just is nothing. There is nothing there. And, you know, there's only so much tea in that cup. There's only so much there to see. And you sometimes have to simply stop and say, like, this is what's here. I have to accept it. And that's where we're going to end for this reading. But You say you're a journalist and you're writing one story and you only have 10 to 15 inches of writing to do. It's really easy to carry over to 25 inches if you love being a journalist and you love talking to people and you love finding things out about circumstances or individuals. I think my favorite thing about journalism was talking to people, was learning their stories, was dipping into different people's lives and finding out how they lived, what they cared about. And that can definitely lead to longer writing, for sure.
Well, since we're on the topic, mm-hmm. I wanted to ask you this question, but I've held off because we're talking about tea leaves. Do you think that real journalism even exists anymore?
I think real individual journalists do exist. And I know some people that I would say still practice it. I think that journalism has changed dramatically in the past few years, the past decade even, from what I fell in love with. There's a lot more tilting in journalism than there used to be, as far as politics and reporting like that are concerned. I think that if you're looking at individual journalists, it's a different story than, say, looking at a channel or looking at a big.com, because they have owners, they have advertisers, and they are influenced by that in ways they didn't used to be. It didn't used to be a thing. When I left journalism, I started to see that happening. And I didn't love that idea because that's not what journalism was supposed to be. It's supposed to be, like I said earlier, truth-telling, watchdog of the community. It was about protecting the greater good of any town or city that you're reporting on. I've never been a national reporter. I can't speak to that. I've never covered national stories. So I have always been more interested in what makes a community, who lives in a community, whose stories are part of the collective of a town or city. That was what I loved in journalism, was that kind of personality of a city. I mean, and if you've lived in multiple cities, you know that every place has a personality. I loved being part of a team in newspapering that sort of helped define it, that helped track its changes, that helped give that personality its voice.
Well, I appreciate you answering that. I find that I don't think there's any real, I think there are journalists, but I don't think journalism in the mainstream media exists anymore.
It has definitely taken a hit.
Generally don't believe it. And I'm not saying it's bad. Like, I think all publications have always slanted in a certain way. Of course, the owner is human. They have a bias. They have not an agenda, but a worldview mm-hmm. that is going to, in general, come out. Some of those people wanted real reporting and would allow that, and other people didn't. And I think that industry got so disrupted with economics mm-hmm. that when they lost the obituaries and the classifieds and car dealerships, they didn't know what to do anymore because they didn't have the revenue. So they had to get clicks.
Yeah.
And it was all about writing what would get the click versus what was the truth. And you kept saying this, and I think it's the reason is, if you want to know how anybody acts and why their behavior is that way, just understand the incentive. It's that simple. Most people won't peel back the onion one layer and then they'll say, that's it. But it's not. It's just keep peeling back the onion. Once you understand the incentive, it's really that simple. It's humans are predictable animals and economics work that way. So I learned that lesson a hard way, probably too many times, because I think the first time you hope it's not true and then you go back. But I can see how you've translated some of those things to asking the questions and seeing things into the tea reading and smoke reading. And in many ways, after this conversation, just have such a deeper appreciation for what it is, which is sort of wild that I'm 50 and gone through my whole life that way and not really known it. So I'm really grateful for you shining the light on that. And I hope that listeners see it differently as well, in that it's not an absolute and it's not an answer, that the answer is not already in someone. It's your ability to find that answer in that person and open that door for them in a way that they're willing to open the door because they're not threatened.
Very well said. Yep.
So with that, you've been a journalist, you're doing tea and smoke readings, you interact with people mm-hmm. all the time. Mm-hmm. If you had to give listeners three pieces of advice, life advice, what would you give them?
Three pieces of life advice. Because my life has changed so many times, I think that my three pieces of advice are this. First, learn to listen. Learn to actually listen. Not just wait to talk, but to absorb what the other person is saying and to be able to reflect it back accurately to them. I think my next piece of advice is to learn to listen to yourself. I think that's an even harder skill. And it will take time and practice and patience, a little bit of self-compassion too, which is in short supply these days. And my third piece of advice would be to listen to your hunches. Everybody has gut feelings and hunches. That's intuition. And it's often correct, probably more often than not. And even if we don't listen to it, it is correct and it will guide you into what is probably better for you, even if it doesn't make sense to your logical mind.
Well, those are very simple and very deep. And I think you've just given listeners a lot to think about and process. Where can people get help processing that and find you?
I am available on my website at teaandsmoke.com.
Teaandsmoke.com. We'll put that in the show notes. Risa, thank you so much for taking the time out of your day to have this conversation. It's been really wonderful. And I still have other questions, but we've gone 2 hours, so I'm going to stop and we'll have you back again. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much, Brandon. I'm glad to have been here.
Bye, everyone.